Thank you so much, Claire. I am a clinical psychologist, and I think this talk will probably betray that fact through and through. I can tell you all about children's worry as a part of children's anxiety, but actually I think it's more useful at primary level to think of worry and anxiety as a very similar thing. And in a way, that my conclusions in the book are around sort of thinking about this in a very developmental way. So I'm going to talk a tiny bit about children's worry, bring it in when I can. But actually, what I'm really interested in talking about today, when I've got an audience of people working within the school system, is thinking about what anxiety in children look like. So Claire was absolutely right. This much more comes from my clinical experience. I can back most of it up with some research findings if you're interested, but hopefully it'll give you a flavour of thinking about anxiety in particular in the school setting. So just want to think about what is anxiety and worry. What does anxiety look like in the classroom? So what might you be seeing? How does anxiety impact children in the classroom or at school? What can teachers do to support those anxious children? And I think really fitting with Claire's introduction about their study, what can teachers do to support the parents of anxious children? I know that many of you, if you've worked with kids around their anxiety in the school setting, you cannot do that without working with the parents as well. And sometimes it's hard to differentiate of exactly where the difficulties lie. So just some ideas around that. What I love interaction, but I think just because of timing, I'm going to run through the presentation and then hopefully we'll come to as many of the questions as we can at the end. So because I guess one of my real interests is children's worry, lots of people ask me, is worry really that different to anxiety? Are they separate things? Is worry a thing that's different? Anxiety is the whole package. So anxiety is that emotion. It's your feelings that you're tense. It's your worried thoughts. It's your anticipation of things that are going to go wrong. It's physical changes like increased blood pressure. So your heart's beating faster. You feel hot and sweaty, tingly hands. So anxiety is the whole of that. And we're all familiar with anxiety. It's absolutely normal. It's sort of there for an evolutionary purpose, that it keeps us safe. The example I often give, and it was because it's a very, very personal, going back to teenage years when I was too busy in a conversation with a friend of putting my leg out into the road about to cross it and the bus just whizzing straight past. That response there, the adrenaline that rushes through you, that is designed to make sure that you don't take a step further and it protects you. So anxiety is really normal. But some people have anxiety that just gets, it's just too much. It's too much to deal with. It's constant. It's about everything. It's just too intense. So one, I know people have said that it's anxiety that have got out of hand. So there might be really recurring intrusive thoughts, intrusive concerns. There might be avoidance of certain situations. So avoiding things that we don't like. And again, thinking of that in a pandemic context, interesting to see the different things that kids might now be avoiding that we would never have seen in previous years. It might be certain kind of safety behaviors, things that keep us safe, and that avoidance is a safety behavior, but there's all sorts of other things that keep us safe. Again, related to the pandemic, we might be cleaning our hands to keep us really, really safe. A young kid might be keeping very close to mum and dad because that keeps them safe. So we've got these kind of avoidance behaviors, these safety behaviors. And then of course you've got your physical symptoms. So you've got your sweating, your trembling, your dizziness, your rapid heartbeat. The explanation I usually give to kids if I'm working with them, or to parents, even to the trainees that I teach, is that sense of, if you think of what adrenaline is trying to do, it's preparing you for fight or flight. So it's getting your large muscles ready to sort of go out there and fight the woolly mammoth. It's always a woolly mammoth. I'm not sure why, but fight the woolly mammoth. But then if you don't do that, you've got all of this excess energy. Your heart is beating your blood around your body so fast, so you're really ready to go, ready to run away, ready to fight, but it's nowhere to go. So of course that's going to heat you up. It's going to make your heart beat fast. You're going to feel tingly in the places that you don't need all that energy in. So in a fighting or flighting is big muscle work. It's not small muscle work. So anxiety is the whole of that. If we think about worry specifically, then worry is that cognitive component. For kids, I describe this as the washing machine thoughts. You can see that red pair of pants go round and round and round and round in the washing machine. You cannot get those sticky, sticky thoughts out of your head. The problem with worry as a kind of sticky thought is that often we ask what if questions in worry. So we ask, what if this might happen? What if that might happen? And as we follow those through, they tend to get more and more negative. So we tend to end up catastrophizing what might happen in the future rather than think about all the sort of range of lovely things and be really balanced in our what if thinking. So they're really designed to solve our problems. So we've thought ahead of different things that might happen, but the threat's really uncertain. So it isn't a problem that's possible to solve. And so that's one of the aspects that makes worry really sticky. One of the key things, I guess, for takeaway today is that as an adult, when you worry, that worry often feels different to something like the fear response. If you go back to me almost walking in front of a bus, being a teenager too engaged in a conversation with a friend, that is a really intense rush of emotion, of adrenaline, a real strong anxiety feeling. And when we get to being an adult, that is quite different to sitting there. Maybe I was thinking, oh, my worries are usually insomniac worries. I wake up in the night and off they go, going round and round and round. In kids, our evidence is they experience worry, fear, anxiety as the same thing. When kids start worrying about things, asking themselves the what if questions, it looks likely that their response is maybe not completely as intense, but more or less as intense as something bad actually happening, a dog barking at them or jumping up at them. So when we're adults, we differentiate between things that possibly could be in these hypotheticals and things that are the dog that looks like it's about to bite us. Little kids, certainly under 7, possibly under 10, don't have that differentiation. So I guess going forward, I'm going to talk about anxiety, but I think the worry comes into it because it's just a different phenomena in these young kids. And again, if we think of the pandemic, that's a really crucial differentiation. Anxiety in childhood is really important because this is when it all starts. If we do tracking back studies, and we can either do this retrospectively, so we can ask people when their anxiety started, or we can do it with large scale databases. And I know that Pravitha is going to talk a bit more about that in her work, but we can track back when it started, and anxiety starts in childhood. Most people who experience specific phobias or separation anxiety will have them by 12, and anxiety peaks at about age 9. Worries can carry on going after that. And if you think of this kind of hypothetical what if, something shifts at around age 11, 12 when kids get a wider sense of what's out there in the world. In terms of what we're looking at, broadly speaking, this is a useful triad where we've got our anxious thoughts and our worries, we've got our safety behaviors and our avoidance, and we've got our feelings of anxiety, fear, and nervousness. So we've got our thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. And it's a really simple model to think about, and it just ties us into the different aspects of anxiety. One of the key things about anxiety, though, is anxiety comes in circles. So you can see that all my arrows here are bidirectional. So if you have the thought in a school setting, if I put my hand up and answer a question, they'll laugh at me. I'll get it wrong. They're going to laugh at me. If you have that thought, you're going to feel really anxious. You're going to feel nervous. And what's the result of that? Well, you don't put your hand up. But what happens with that behavior? Well, first of all, that in itself might trigger off other thoughts that make you feel more anxious and nervous. But also, if you don't put your hand up, you don't ever find out they don't laugh at you. So you end up reinforcing the thought. So one of the crucial things about anxiety is that in anxiety, there's nearly always these circles that we can find, these cycles that reinforce each other. So over time, it can get worse and worse and worse. And one of the things that I guess as a clinical psychologist, if I'm working therapeutically with a child, is that I'm trying to break those circles. And so when we talk about what schools can do, it's about how can we break those circles in a school setting that's sensitive to context within the capabilities and the duties and the responsibilities of teachers, but still supporting those kids, because those feelings are really powerful and strong. I probably don't need to tell you this, but just thinking about what might anxiety look like in the classroom. I guess what I want to highlight here is that you might absolutely see classic anxiety symptoms. I know that even in my daughter's school, they have been horrified over the last number of years. It's not just pandemic related, but maybe over the last 5 or 10 years, teachers who've been teaching for years, decades, are suddenly seeing younger kids who are coming to school and are experiencing panic attacks. It just seems to be something different. And again, our next talk will address some of that, I'm sure. But something is happening. So you might see those really obvious signs of anxiety. You might see not necessarily the worry, but the reassurance seeking that comes with worry. Miss, what if this is going to happen? Do you think that's going to happen? And that reassurance seeking might be a sign of the anxiety. However, what about those other signs? A long time ago, Joan Stevenson Hind in Cambridge did some lovely work on very young kids, so the 4 and 5 year olds, and what anxiety looks like there. And certainly the years ago when she did it, it might be different now, what she found was that the young boys, the 4 and 5 year old boys who were highly, highly anxious, looked like they were acting out. We saw more behavioral problems, we saw more aggression. Now, that doesn't surprise me in the slightest, because of course I've talked about fight or flight. And so actually that fight reaction or that flight reaction is a completely normal response to feeling anxious, feeling threatened. So we see acting out. We also see the withdrawal from activities. The kids who used to put their hand up to answer a question or get involved in PE and games and like their sports, or even time on yard or break times, that withdrawal from peer groups. So that can merge into depressive symptoms, but actually that withdrawal and the idea that if I do this, something bad might happen, that can be a sign that anxiety is happening in the classroom. And then finally, problems with transitions. We know that some of the kids with neurodiversity, so kids who might meet criteria for ADHD or autism, they might well have specific problems with transitions. But actually, one of the things that keeps us safe in anxiety is knowing what's going to happen next and having things predictable. So again, absences and late attendance can be signs that kids are really anxious. So what can you do? These are the two models that I think are really helpful to keep in mind, because they're simple heuristics, they're simple models, and I think it goes straight to the heart of things that are hopefully practical, but also are within that kind of remit of what being a teacher is. So I think much as there are loads of criticisms of attachment as a model of various things, attachment again comes from this idea that kids have a need for proximity, have a need to be kept safe, and they will seek out that safety using certain kinds of behaviour. But when we look at whether they're securely attached, whether they seem to be able to do that, get comfort, but then go back out into the world, there's two parts to it. Often when we talk as clinicians, when we talk about attachment, there's a tendency to think of just that secure base, that sort of safe person to go to. And that's really, really important. But actually, there's an equally important part to attachment when we're thinking about anxiety, and that is support for exploration of the environment. So if we look at the strain situation, which tests attachment in 18-month-olds, we're interested in what the infant does when a stranger comes in, but we're also looking for how quickly the infant gets comfort and then goes back out to play with toys. So again, thinking about anxiety in the classroom, it's not just being that person that the child comes to and feels comforted and can be calmed down from a panicky experiences. It's also the teacher who then is confident in encouraging that child to re-engage with the world. And vice versa. Again, I've seen teachers who are absolutely brilliant at that kind of the re-engagement, but maybe struggle a bit more with being that kind of secure base, that warm, safe person to come to. And some love being that warm, safe person to come to, but are maybe a bit nervous. That's true of teachers. It's true of parents. It's true of adults. It's one of those things that often what we have, one of those that we feel more comfortable with. But one of the key things that we can do with anxiety is hold both of those in our mind together. The other thing to say, the other model I really like, and I use this therapeutically, is this is complete heuristic. There is no evidence base for this whatsoever. It's just a useful way of thinking about it. Is anxiety is the likelihood of threat times the severity of threat divided by your own coping skills and the support you're offered. And I just really like that, because some kids I've worked with, the severity of what they're worried about is extreme. And so even though it's a small likelihood, it's still a big thing. Some are worried about something that doesn't seem that severe, but it just seems so likely to them that they're thinking about it the whole time. Others, the threat is sort of, it's there, it's in the ether, but what they really worry about is how they're going to cope. And finally, some just feel that they haven't got that secure base. They haven't got that support. They've got some coping skills, but when it gets really bad, they need someone else on their side. And again, the reason I like this is that it gives you some ideas of where you might play a role in it, in terms of understanding the threat, understanding the coping, and offering the support. So things that make it harder for the classroom to be a secure base, none of these will come as a surprise to you. Bullying and has to be top of the list. We know that not only does bullying have a very strong relationship with anxiety and anxiety disorders, I don't even want to say non-severe, but bullying has a very close relationship with trauma as well. We know that bullying can be very explicit, but those kind of more subtle bullying techniques, being excluded or made to feel different, is important. Feeling pressure to be the same as others, and then failing either in terms of having unrealistic expectations, either of self or other people having unrealistic expectations of you, or setting up competitions. So it's really important to be the best or better than. Things that we know happen in classrooms that we know shouldn't happen in classrooms, and they do because teachers are human too. Children report being belittled, being singled out, or being humiliated. Again, I'm hoping that some of that is in our legacy, that certainly in the schools I work with, this is extremely rare, but just occasionally it's there. And that relates to stressed teachers. Just like if you've got a very, very stressed parent, that's not usually the parent that you go to when you're feeling anxious, under threat in some way. The same is true as for teachers. I just put lion's roar in here. I have sort of anxious kids myself, whether that's kind of within normal bounds or whether it's beyond isn't really for today. But I always include them, and this was their response. It's when lions roar. If you had lions in the classroom, then it would be really scary. It is there because it makes me smile, but it's also worth thinking about, are there any real threats in the classroom? And that's really relevant thinking about COVID. Now we know from the all the stuff that's coming out in terms of how kids experience COVID and passing on, that actually it could be quite minor threat, but actually our whole narrative around this is not necessarily about how it feels for ourselves, but passing it on to people who are vulnerable. So just that COVID makes, you know, it's there for fun because it's a real threat that will be really scary. COVID might be one of those real threats that's really scary. How can you reduce the threat? Identify what the threat is. And these are just some of the ideas that I had of threats that kids have told me about, things that are in the literature. And in terms of reducing the threat, identify the behavior that you want to support. So whether it's answering questions, getting things wrong, being different, sensory issues, offer praise and rewards for small steps towards that goal. So what's a reasonable goal for this particular child to achieve? And what can you offer them in terms of praise or any kind of those classroom rewards for making, producing small steps towards that goal? We're not going to get to the ultimate goal straight away. We're going to get that eventually. Things that you can do to support children's coping: set limits around their anxious behaviors, including avoidance or withdrawal. But that's limits. And again, some kids will need kind of really broad boundaries because they'll struggle with close limits. And some kids with very strong boundaries, very firm, quite narrow boundaries, they thrive because they know exactly what's expected of them. Manage your own reassurance seeking. So you have to be there. You have to be the secure base. But then we move on. We move back into, go out into the environment, go back into the classroom, and the support to do that. Encourage kids to take the next small step and reinforce any efforts at coping. So even if they're not doing a great job, what are they doing that's really positive, and how can you reinforce it? There might be someone within the school who might take the lead for those kids who are really struggling with those coping skills. I think I'm coming to the end now, but just say, what can you do to support the parents? The first thing I'd say is believe them and validate their experience of the child. It's perfectly possible that what you see is the kid putting on their best face in the classroom. It's very possible you see the kid just letting everything go in the classroom too. But just if parents have got a different sense of their kid, it's not necessarily because they're over anxious. Some might be, but it's because things are different at home. So the first thing you have to do is believe them. Work with the parents to create strategies that work across home and school. If the kids are doing the same thing in both, they've got the same approach of this kind of reassure, be there, be supportive, and then slow steps to gain that confidence and those skills. And if that's doing across both, they're going to learn those skills quicker. Maintain communication. Which school doesn't have that as one of their goals? Identify and reduce the threat for the parent. The threat for the parent is different to the threat from the kids. We might get into it in Q&A, but the co-space study based in Oxford looked at what the kids were worried about going back to school and what the parents were worried about going back to school. And those are different things. So the threat for the parent might be about my kid running out of school and being unsafe, not the threat to the child, which is talking in the classroom. And again, develop parenting coping skills, the same as for the kids. Can the parents who are really anxious allow you to have that control for a little bit longer every day, or to encourage their child to do the next thing? The words of wisdom from my then 10-year-old, she's now 12, but she still stands over it. Make sure that you know that you are there for them, and be friendly, but strict when you need to be. And I think I'll leave it there.